The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating more than a half century of promoting awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business.
It's a real pleasure for me to be here speaking at the Society. As many of you know, I'm a proud member of the Society and have been so for a number of years. I'm also a member of the International Association of Korean Lawyers and spend a fair amount of my practice dealing with legal issues as they relate to high technology between the United States and the Republic of Korea. So it's a real pleasure for me to be able to speak with you this morning about these events. They are timely issues. They're at the top of the press's agenda. They're at the top of the government's agenda, and they're at the top of the agenda of law enforcement. And so what I wanted to spend a little bit of time on this morning with you is talking about one piece of the cybersecurity puzzle, the cybersecurity conundrum, using as the prism through which to examine these pressing issues, the issue of data breaches, and specifically the issue of data breaches that result in a company or an organization's loss of personal information about its consumers, customers, or its employees. So we're going to be speaking this morning about some of the key legal drivers and decision points that corporate managers need to understand when they have a data spill or a data loss. Now, I'm distinguishing what I've just described as a data spill or a data loss involving PII from other bad things that can happen to companies or organizations when it comes to cybercrime. If there's time at the end, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have about that. But for purposes of the next 45 minutes or so, we're not going to be talking about hackers which break into a company's systems to destroy the systems, to plant logic bombs on the company's computers. We're not going to be talking about that, although it's an interesting topic. We're not going to be talking about the theft of crown jewel intellectual property, codes, algorithms, blueprints, schematics, and business plans, which again is an interesting subject unto itself. Today, what we're going to be talking about are the legal drivers that companies need to be aware of when it comes to the loss of data that they hold about other people. And so with that in mind, let me just kind of go over what the specific objectives are for today. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about breach notification laws and how those laws impose upon companies obligations to report when they've had a data loss or a data spill involving personally identifiable information. I'm going to refer to that throughout the talk as PII. We're going to speak a little bit about what it's like to work with law enforcement in this context, which oftentimes gets involved because, quite frequently, they're the ones that are letting the company know about the data loss or the data spill. We're going to talk about some of the most important decision points that corporate managers have to make and why they need to be made. And we're going to talk about some real-world issues that come up in these types of events. Now, I've been already talking a little bit about PII, personally identifiable information. Just so that we're all on the same page, let me define that as it's defined under the law and for purposes for which it matters. What we're talking about when we talk about PII is someone's name in combination with other data about them. For example, their name plus their bank account information, their name plus their social security number, their name plus their computer password, information which includes both their name and some other information that could be used to perpetrate an identity theft crime against them, or to defraud them, or to take money out of their bank account and the like. As you might imagine, many companies have a great deal of this type of PII on not only their customers, but their employees as well. So what could be the way in which a company has to face these legal issues? Well, as I mentioned a few moments ago, it could be brought to the company's attention by law enforcement, and that's often the case. So let's say that you're a company and you get a call from law enforcement. It could be the FBI, it could be the Secret Service. In this case, let's say it's the Secret Service. The Secret Service calls you as the corporate manager to tell you that your company and your company's personally identifiable information has been found out to have been stolen. During the execution of a search warrant in a small town in California, records were found inside a location, inside someone's apartment, that seemed to have come from your company. Now, the investigation that law enforcement was undertaking had nothing to do necessarily with your company, had actually nothing even to do with identity theft, but nonetheless, when they were executing a search warrant, they came across a stack of printed records that seemed to have come from your company. What the investigation then finds is that that information has been and could be part of a larger identity theft crime that could also be going on. Again, there's, let's say, names and social security numbers and addresses of your customers. And that could be, again, whether you're a B2C company or even a B2B company. And they realize that, you know, maybe this information was obtained from your company, either perhaps through a hack from an outsider hacking into your company, or it could be even from a corrupt employee working inside your company who's giving that information out to people who are engaged in wrongdoing. They'd like to interview some of the employees at your company, and they ask you if that's okay. Can they come on over? They also tell you, by the way, please don't let anyone know about this. Because this is a sensitive law enforcement investigation, because we don't want anyone who's involved in the wrongdoing to either destroy evidence or maybe even flee the jurisdiction, we're going to ask you, Mr., Ms., CEO, or COO, whoever gets the call, maybe it's the GC, we're going to ask you not to tell anyone, okay? And again, we're not going to kind of order you not to tell anyone, but we're going to ask that of you just on a voluntary basis, okay? Well, that kind of leads to your very first decision point, and that is, you know, what do you do? You know, have you thought about this event before? You know, do you have an incident response plan to deal with this kind of situation? Now, if you're a big company, particularly if you're a big B2C company with information on lots and lots of consumers and users, hopefully, presumably, you do have an incident response plan. You have some go-to document, which is going to kind of lay out the roadmap at the top level, lay out the roadmap for you and your internal managers and employees, the people tasked with addressing this situation, which is going to tell them exactly what to do and what not to do in this situation. I mean, a classic example of a large-scale data breach where you would hope a company would have an incident response plan was the data breach that happened a few years back involving Sony and the hack of its PlayStation game portal. And that intrusion, as you recall, involved the theft of not only people's names and email addresses, but their credit card information as well, because they used their credit cards and debit cards and bank account information to pay for the services they brought. Now, I don't know. I didn't work with Sony on that particular matter. I work with other big companies on those kind of matters. But again, a company of that size or even a smaller company would presumably have an incident response plan to deal with this issue. Well, who do you call? You know, who do you have to notify about this event internally and externally? Do you have a reportable event to state law enforcement officials? Now, I mentioned that, you know, we're talking about defined PII to include things like names and social security numbers, names and people's bank account information. The reporting laws of various states will actually define and tell you when you have to let state officials know if you've had a data breach involving PII. And it's kind of a historical curiosity, but I think it's quite interesting, and so I'll spend a little bit of time talking about it. But until about 10 years ago, those breach reporting laws didn't really exist. Prior to 2003, if a company lost all of its customers' information, all of its consumers' information, or all of its employee PII, again, name and social security number, name and bank account information, it really didn't have any legal obligations under the law to tell anyone. That began to change in 2003 when California passed a breach reporting law, which made it obligatory and compulsory for companies to report those types of data spills to the State Attorney General of California. Other states followed suit, and today the law in the United States is such that there are about 46 to 48 different states that require companies to report to state law enforcement officials when they've had a data breach involving PII. But here's the catch. All of those laws vary. Sometimes they vary a little bit among each other. Sometimes they vary a lot among each other. And because they vary, because there's no one uniform standard, one of the very first decisions that a corporate manager is going to face is whether or not they have a breach reporting law to that particular state. And most of the states say that you have a breach reporting law to them if there's PII, as they define it, involving one of their residents. Okay? What that means, of course, is that if you're a company that has consumers or employees in more than one state, you're probably going to wind up having to look at the laws of a bunch of different states where your consumers or your employees are residents of those states to determine whether or not the PII that you lost qualifies as defined PII, which will trigger a breach reporting obligation under that state's law. That's a very, very important decision point that you're going to hit with right up front. Who do I need to report this to? Which state officials? If I have employee or consumer information from 10 different states, is it PII as those 10 different states define it? And if so, who in those states do I have to report it to? And again, who you report it to in the state varies depending on the state. That's what I just mentioned. You know, when is it triggered? Another decision point that's going to be one of your first decision points is whether or not you wait for law enforcement's go-ahead before deciding that you need to report that to the consumers and the customers. Now, some states say that you don't need to report it to the state or you don't need to report it to the consumers if law enforcement has asked you to keep it quiet. But not all states have those laws. So you're very quickly going to need to get a handle on whether you have defined PII under that state's law that you need to report, which state residents have been affected, and finally, whether or not the state in question will allow you to hold off on reporting until the law enforcement officials say that it's okay. Okay? You know, what do you do in these first few hours, in these first couple of days? Do you inform other people outside your organization? Maybe you have cyber insurance that covers this event. And because these events can be quite expensive, having that insurance could be quite beneficial. But some insurance policies require you to notify them immediately of the event so that coverage can begin. They have these kind of very tight timetables on which you must notify them in order for you to be covered. It may be 5 days, it could be 10 days, it could be 20 days. What do you do if the FBI has told you or the Secret Service has told you not to notify anyone for 3 weeks? 21 days, and your insurance policy says that in order for you to be covered, you have to notify the insurance carrier within 20 days. What do you do? Do you tell the insurance carrier and thereby get your coverage, but maybe you compromise the investigation because maybe it leaks out through the insurance company or otherwise? Or do you try and work with law enforcement, keep things quiet for 21 days so that you can try and find out, whether it was an outsider or an insider who stole your company records and maybe lose coverage for the event. These are very, very tough decisions. And they're made even tougher because, for the most part, many companies that experience these types of data breaches are going to be dealing with this data breach, this type of data breach, for the very first time. The most prepared company for a data breach of this type is a company that's experienced a data breach exactly like this. Okay, but based on my experience, the calls that I tend to get, and I've been working with victims of all types of cybercrime for over 15 years, tend to be from first-time victims, right? And so the corporate managers who are going to be responsible for making these decisions are going to be making them for the very first time. Not only that, they're going to be making them with imperfect information, right? Because the breach notification laws will oftentimes require you to notify law enforcement within 48 hours, 72 hours, 1 week, whatever it is. And in a cyber event of any magnitude, before you get your technical analysis done, your forensic analysis done, your employees' interviews done, it's going to take a lot more than that. So the corporate manager who's dealing with this situation for the very first time is oftentimes going to be dealing with it on a very tight time frame. And he or she is going to have to make decisions about whether to report, who to report to, and whether they have even a reportable event without full and without full information. They're going to be dealing essentially with decision making in a fog bank. And as any of you know who've worked in corporate governance and corporate management, managers don't like to make decisions in a fog bank. But that's exactly the kind of decision making that's going to be going on here. Now, complicating this factor is the fact that the decision making that needs to happen will need to happen in a tight time frame, and it will be irrevocable, right? Because once you report to law enforcement, once you report to your insurance carrier, once you decide to ignore the Secret Service's advice and go public with the event, or you know, abide by the law enforcement's request and keep it secret, chances are the decision you make is not going to have a take it back switch, right? So the corporate manager really is between a rock and three hard places, right? They're making decisions that they have to make very, very quickly with imperfect information, and the decisions are irrevocable. And I can think of few examples where corporate CEOs, CFOs, COOs, general counsels have those three difficulties that are on their plate at the same time. And I got to tell you, from dealing with corporate managers in these crisis situations, while it's fairly routine for me because I've dealt with these crisis situations regularly enough, I can tell you that it's not routine for them, and it really is a time where they earn their pay. They don't just get the corner offices and the executive dining rooms for nothing. This is a true example of where corporate managers earn their pay. Okay. Well, let's say that you decide that your company and your company has customers in all 50 states as well as overseas. Maybe only about 15% of those customers have any financial data stored with their profiles. Okay, so let's say that the list that was found during the execution of the search warrant had 10,000 names on it. Well, you can whittle down, perhaps, let's say, to about 15% of that universe, the number of PII data points that may trigger reporting. You may also be able to whittle it down further because the clients who have stored financial data may, if you get lucky, reside in only four states. Let's say, for purposes of argument, New York, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and California. That could make your job considerably easier. And by the way, just as an aside, this is an extremely important exercise, and you need to undertake it. You need to undertake it to know what your reporting obligations are, to know how much you must report. But undertaking the exercise can actually also help you because you may actually be able to come to the conclusion that you don't have a reportable event. I'll give you a for example. A few years ago, we were attained by a large company that realized that as a result of a permission change, that as a result of a change management snafu to an upgrade on its software systems, permission misconfigurations to their online employee portal for time off and vacation data was left unsecured. As a result of that snafu, everyone inside the company for a 38-minute window could, if they logged on and put in someone else's name, not their own name, but just typed in someone else's name, see the information about that other person. So they could see that person's time off, how much time they vacation time they had, how much vacation time they had used, and critically importantly, their salary information and their bank account information into which their checks went for direct deposit. Now, you might imagine that, putting aside, this was just an internal snafu, there was no question of hackers, and so it was not a major security breach, significant enough, but not a major security breach, and so it didn't have major kind of contractual or business implications outside the company, but you might imagine that from an internal corporate morale point of view, it had actually quite significant implications. What we were able to figure out, however, doing this analysis, is that as a result of being able to figure out exactly what employees had logged on to the other employees' information, the universe of people who potentially looked at other people's information was whittled down to residents of only one state. So even though the system was wide open for 38 minutes and every employee in the company could, in theory, look at everyone else's information, only about 20 or so employees did. And of those 20, about six or so were members of the legal department who were alerted to this information and were just kind of testing out whether or not the vulnerability existed, so we didn't have to worry about them. And of the remaining 14 or so, they only resided in states where there was not a breach reporting obligation under this particular set of circumstances. Okay? Does that make sense to everybody? So basically, you need to undertake the analysis. You need to figure out exactly what it is that your breach reporting obligations are. That could result in a mass notification. It could result in no notification. You have to get it right. That's the key point. Okay. The investigation continues, and decisions continue as well that your managers are going to need to make. Let's say that you decide to allow the Secret Service to go ahead and interview employees at your office. You're not going to tell anyone other than senior management about this. You conduct your investigation. That's supervised by counsel. And you figure out that what happened here was that an outsider was using authentic company credentials belonging to an employee. By looking at the log data, you're able to figure out that the printout is actually a screenshot of information from your system created by an individual who logged into the system remotely, okay? So now maybe you have like insiders working together with outsiders. But again, a good forensic analysis, good technical analysis, supervised by counsel can really help you out on this. This then leads to your conclusion. One of your conclusions is that the outsider has authentic credentials of the suspect, but that it's unlikely that the suspect created the printouts. However, you still don't know the extent of the breach or whether any fraudulent misuse has been made. Okay? And that's actually an important thing to do. Now, one other point before we progress, and that is this. What you decide to do based on this is to hold off on notifying your customers. You're going to actually conclude your investigation. You get clearance from law enforcement. Still, though, you need to know what you're going to do in the future, okay? So let's say the first decision point that you've come to is to keep things quiet, not conduct a broad notification, keep it quiet long enough for the government to do their investigation. Maybe you're lucky, you don't have one of these insurance policies which triggers instant notification to them. And so you're going to keep things quiet for a little bit and see where things go with the government's investigation. Now, I mentioned the supervision by counsel. Why is that important? It's important because your in-house legal team and your outside legal team bring to bear not only an understanding of the laws that apply in this situation, they're going to be the ones that tell you whether you have a reportable event or not, but they also bring to bear what your other obligations are. You may have obligations to other companies, you may have obligations contractual to shareholders, you may have obligations to corporate affiliates. Finally, the other thing that corporate counsel bring to bear on this is the fact that their work is at least arguably protected by the attorney-client and work product privilege. And that's an extremely important point here. When you have a cyber incident of any kind of magnitude or severity, it could be a data breach of PII like we're talking about here, it could be an intrusion into the systems, it could be a theft of crown jewel intellectual property, whatever it is, it's absolutely critical for you to get your in-house lawyers and expert outside counsel involved. And that's because if you don't, if let's say the CEO simply hires a technology consultant to help them sort this out, typically, ordinarily, the communications between that CEO and the technology consultant will not be privileged or protected, okay? Now, why does that matter? That matters because, as I mentioned, there are these breach reporting obligations which require you to report certain incidents to state law enforcement officials. Those reports are public. Increasingly, what state law enforcement officials are doing in response to these reports of particularly the loss of consumer information is they're conducting investigations of the companies in order to determine whether the companies were negligent in how they handled that information, in how they cared for that information. And if they have been negligent, they're bringing lawsuits against those companies, civil lawsuits, but still, you know, lawsuits with very, very large damage numbers attached to them. They're bringing lawsuits against those companies for violations of the state consumer protection laws, okay? And that's been happening. It's, you know, happened in every major data breach, TJ Maxx, Sony PlayStation, Hannaford's, the list goes on and on. If your communications on the event are not protected by the attorney-client or work product privilege, those communications will almost certainly be after turned over to the state law enforcement officials who will request them in their subpoenas or their document demands, Okay. What does that mean on a practical level? What that means on a practical level is that all of your conversations, your analyses, your studies about whatever deficiencies may have led to the breach or loss, you're basically going to be turning over to the people that are going to be suing you for negligence and breach of fiduciary duty. And as you know, it doesn't take a law degree to figure out that when you hand your potential adversary the playbook to your vulnerabilities, you've essentially given them the roadmap on how to extract a lot of money outside of from your company. It gets worse though, because plaintiffs' lawyers, as a result of these breach notification laws, become aware of the breaches when they occur and very quickly start soliciting plaintiffs for class action lawsuits against companies, again, alleging breach of fiduciary duty and negligence in the securing of that information. So for example, in the Sony PlayStation breach, that case spawned, I think, several dozen plaintiffs' class action lawsuits. And as any of you know, who travel in the law in these circles at all, once a company's hit with a class action lawsuit, the incentives for that company to settle on very favorable terms to the plaintiffs and the plaintiffs' lawyers is extremely, extremely strong. Because what company wants to go to trial against a group of plaintiffs who've had their information lost? So most of these cases, the vast majority of them, settle with the companies paying out significant amounts of money. So this, and the same point applies there too. The plaintiffs' lawyers have become very, very smart and very, very savvy. And what they've asked for in their document requests in those litigations from the companies are all copies of studies, plans, analysis, reports, emails, and other communications which have described the security breach and the security event. And again, if you're turning over essentially your laundry list of deficiencies and all the areas in which you, you know, kind of failed or could have done better, what you're giving to the plaintiffs' lawyers and the adversaries essentially is a roadmap to their lawsuit, okay? You're basically giving them their opening arguments to the litigation. On the other hand, if you've done everything you could to secure this information, then at least you have an argument that some of that information can be kept out of the hands of those wrongdoers, of the plaintiffs' lawyers. The information about the wrongdoers included among that information, okay? So critical to keep it secure. All right, but you're also going to be faced with another decision point. And that is, who do you notify? Do you notify clients and other customers beyond the ones that had their PII stolen? Do you notify everyone in the database, just those with financial information? Do you notify the individuals only in those four states? Do you notify state regulators? Do you notify federal regulators? Do you notify credit reporting bureaus? They play an important role in this event as well. Again, one of the key points here is that you may have obligations that go beyond your obligations to notify state regulators. You may have obligations to notify federal regulators as well. And for companies that are, either trafficking in personal health information or companies that have information on consumers and customers where the company is registered with the SEC, you might have reporting obligations to federal regulators as well. You may also want to notify credit reporting bureaus, okay? So once you've decided what states are in play and who your obligations are to, you still then have to decide, do you keep it to that minimum subset of consumers and customers, or do you, as a courtesy, maybe notify everyone, okay? Well, let's say that you make the decision as follows. You decide to notify only those individuals who have financial information in the database. Only some of the clients in New York, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and California, the appropriate state regulators, and the credit bureaus. So you don't send out notifications. You're not going to send out notifications to every single one of your customers in all 50 states. You're only going to limit it to the states where you have to. And that is, depending on the facts, a rational decision that a company can make. Well, looking at that matrix, that results in you having to send out approximately 20,000 letters to those individuals. And typically, the state reporting laws will tell you how you notify them, whether it's first-class mail, certified mail, whether you can notify them by email, et cetera, and so forth. Some of you may be asking, okay, well, what does this exactly mean? You know, does this mean that the CEO is, you know, licking the back of 20,000 letters? And the answer, of course, is clearly no. You also, probably have experienced this yourself as consumers. You get a letter from a bank or from a company that you've done business with that says something along the lines of, you know, we're writing to advise you that your information may have been compromised by individuals. You know, we're investigating this matter. We have no reason to believe that you specifically were targeted or that you have been defrauded, but we're notifying you of this. And here's a number you can call for further information. And here are some answers to frequently asked questions. Most of you probably have gotten a letter like that because I think if you look at the most latest statistics, approximately 2/3 to 3/4 of all Americans have had their identities stolen at one point or another. So the odds are pretty high that many of you have gotten a form letter like that. Some of you read it, some of you didn't, some of you may have called the 1-800 number, some of you may have not, but these are the kind of letters that we're talking about. And there are providers that are out there that will do the letters for you and stand up the call center. Now, you're going to have to make decisions there too, okay? And we'll get to that in a moment. But what about other entities in the ecosystem? Maybe there are key customers that you will want to notify or need to notify. Again, these are businesses perhaps, and you may not have any of their PII, but maybe you want to get out ahead of any of the negative publicity that can result from this type of event and talk to some of your key business partners to let them know that you're on this, that you're aware of it, that you have the situation under control, and to alleviate any concerns that they have. I've been, you know, called on a number of occasions by clients of mine who have heard that just a business partner of theirs had a data breach, and they want to know what questions they should ask their business partner to give them comfort that the business partner knows what it's doing, has taken appropriate steps in the area of computer security, and is on top of the event. So there's reputational kind of comfort that you may need to give to key customers and suppliers. You may also have to have communications to your corporate affiliates. I mean, you could be the U.S. subsidiary of a big chaebol in Korea, and the question may come up, you know, well, do you have to notify the home office? At what point? What's the trigger point? I mean, if you lose, if you have a data spill involving, you know, 5,000 people's identity, is that something that you, you know, you pick up the hot phone to Seoul about? Or is it 10,000? Or is it 20,000? Is it an event that you think can expose you to $500,000 in claims and damages, $1 million, $2 million, whatever it is? Hopefully you've baked that into your incident response plan and have thought about that ahead of time so that that decision isn't made on the fly, isn't made without thought, and of course, worst of all, doesn't fall through the cracks. Okay, because the last thing you want are your managers in Seoul reading in the Seoul Times about a data breach that happened to one of their subsidiaries in the U.S. who reported it to the New York State Attorney General that, you know, posted it on their data breach website. You know, there may not be, you know, necessarily legal ramifications for that. There could be career ramifications, which probably, you know, may concern you even more than any legal ramifications to the company. All right. But the decisions are not over there. The decisions will keep coming at you. You know, you're going to have to, as I mentioned a moment ago, choose notification vendor for consumer notice. Which entity are you dealing with? And there are a bunch of companies out there that do it. They all vary greatly in terms of what they offer, the proposals, how they go about verifying people's addresses, whether they kind of remove deceased individuals. You know, you could have the identity of someone who was deceased that was stolen. You know, where do you send that letter? Do you dedupe that? How do you dedupe that? Are you going to offer credit monitoring? It's not free. You know, you're going to have to pay for it if you offer it. Are you offering credit monitoring to potentially affected individuals or not? If so, for how long? 1 year, 2 year, 3 years? Or are you just kind of referring them to public resources that may be out there for people to protect their identities? You're going to have to stand up a call center. Again, your breach notification vendor will do this. You're going to have that breach notification vendor, by the way, retained by your counsel, okay? So that all the communications between the breach notification vendor and you go through the lawyer to protect the attorney-client privilege, as I mentioned a moment ago. You're going to have to make decisions, though, about, you know, what, how long the call center should be up for. Are you going to have a 1-800 number that people can call for a year, for 6 months, for 1 month, for 90 days? Okay. What are the call center operators going to be saying? Who's paying for all this? Is it covered by your insurance policy? Is it covered by reserves that you've held back for? Is it covered maybe by a corporate affiliate, maybe by the parent? You're going to have to think about all these issues ahead of time. And again, these are the very kind of issues that you're going to be flagging and putting in your incident response plan for the few of you that are out there that don't yet have one ready to go off the shelf. Okay, so the investigation continues. After about 3 weeks, law enforcement comes to the conclusion that it was, in fact, one of your employees who was working with a group of outsiders who were part of the identity theft ring. The insider gave the outsiders his login credentials, and the outsiders then remotely logged in to gain access to the databases from which the printouts were then downloaded. Some members of the ring have been arrested, and the Secret Service now tells you you can be notifying affected individuals. You've immediately done the right thing. You have your breach notification vendor ready to go, and you're just waiting for that call from the Secret Service, and you say to the breach notification vendor that you've hired, okay, Monday is our drop date. We're going to put letters in the mail on Monday. We're going to stand up the call center starting on Tuesday, because some people actually do get their mail the next day. You'd be surprised. And you're going to keep it running for, let's say, 90 days. And off your letters go. You're off to the races. You're just waiting for this to hit. You're going to have, before we get to after incident remediation, you're also going to have prepared in there your FAQs, your frequently asked questions for the call center operators to answer. You're going to have, and those are going to be drafted by your lawyers, right? Because you don't want to be saying anything that's going to get you into legal trouble down the road. So you're going to have your FAQs drafted up, ready to go. You're going to also have probably a press statement, a statement to issue to the press when the press calls, right? I mean, most companies realize that just saying no comment is no longer a good press strategy, okay? What you're going to be extremely careful to do here is say everything that you absolutely must say to give your consumers and regulators and your business partners comfort that you are on top of this situation, that you've hired the right people, that you've put all business aside and you are focusing on this like a laser beam, while at the same time not saying too much, okay? And above all, not saying anything that's inaccurate, okay? One of the reasons why Sony was subjected to so much criticism following their data breach a couple of years ago is because they made statements to the press, which they then had to retract when those statements turned out not to be 100% accurate. And again, what you're aiming for here is not 99% accuracy, you're aiming for 100% accuracy. And so oftentimes, you know, less is more, and saying less will be more important than saying more, the key point being making sure that what you say does not expose you to any further legal liability, doesn't say too much, doesn't say too little, and above all, is completely correct. Of course, it will take a great deal of discipline for your internal corporate people to not go beyond the press statement that you've decided on. In some cases, and I've had these, you know, you may decide that, you know, you are required to answer questions live or to have a press conference. We generally don't advise that. But in the right case, and in certain cases, it's necessary. And if you have the right corporate manager who you can trust in front of a microphone or to take live questions, then it's something that, you know, you may want to go ahead with. Obviously, that person will need to be trained in order to understand what the law is and what they can say and what they can't say. But you're going to have a press relations strategy, a shareholders relations strategy, and an internal employee relations strategy in effect and in place, so that you can deal with these events in an effective way, okay? All right, so off your letters go, you're off to the races. Before we get to after incident remediation, let me just kind of tell you what happened in a recent case that we handled following our sending of the letters and just give you some practical tips. And again, I won't be mentioning anything specific. It was a large data breach involving a lot of personally identifiable information from people from a number of states. As it so happened, the government gave us clearance to send out notification letters right before a major 3-day holiday weekend. Okay, so we called the breach notification vendor, I think on like maybe Friday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon before a 3-day weekend. And we said, we've got clearance from the Secret Service, let the letters go. So the letters, it took a day to print out the letters. The letters were printed on Saturday and they got dumped into Saturday's mail. Okay. Monday was a federal holiday. Believe it or not, some consumers got their letter on Tuesday morning. It actually happened. We stood up the call center naturally Friday to be live. As soon as business opened on Tuesday morning, so 9 a.m. Tuesday morning, our call center was ready to go. We had the hours of the call center posted in the letter that we sent. On that Friday, we also made a notification to a state regulator, and the state regulator in question had notification done through a form, okay? It was simply an online form that the company filled out, very basic information about the intrusion, what happened, you know, when the company became aware of it, how many individuals were affected, the nature of the information, whether it was an insider or an outsider who was responsible. And we, I think it was maybe around 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a Friday before a long 3-day weekend, that we hit send. At 8 o'clock that night, I got an email back from the state regulator saying, why did it take you so long to report this to consumers? Okay. We had only been sitting on this information for about 3 weeks at the request of the law enforcement. I was a regulator myself. I often worked after hours, but I got to tell you, I was impressed that someone in the state attorney general's office in that particular state took their roles and responsibilities so seriously that, you know, at 8 o'clock in the evening over a long, warm summer holiday weekend, they emailed me back asking that one simple question. And of course, it's a simple question, but how you answer that question is not so simple, right? Because now you're dealing with a regulator who's raised a question about whether or not you acted properly and whether or not you sat on the information for too long. Now, of course, you know, the good news for us was, you know, we had a very good answer to that question, okay? You know, the Secret Service had asked us voluntarily not to disclose that information. Nonetheless, we spent a good part of that weekend crafting our exact response, okay? Because, again, I know from being a regulator that very first encounter with a regulator is extremely important, and you want to get off on a good footing with that regulator so that you demonstrate to that regulator, you know, your good faith and how serious you are about doing what's right, you know, for the state, for the consuming public, and for the public at large. So we actually spent the whole weekend going back and forth with the corporate CEO and the general counsel crafting a short response, which we then sent out to the regulator at 9 o'clock in the morning on Tuesday morning. Demonstrating, obviously, that we were on this situation. A couple of other practical points that are important to mention. Make sure that your call center operators are sufficiently well-trained. Ours were, we thought, but there were still a few gaps in their knowledge about the overall nature of the company. A lot of people who received our letters tended to be older. People who were simply calling in to find out more about the type of information that was lost and why the company needed it and why the company had it. And so educating the call center people about the nature of our business was actually extremely important. Again, our population tended to skew towards older people. Older people tend to respond to these letters and actually call into the call center on a greater percentage than younger people for whatever reason. And if you're dealing with a good breach notification vendor, they can actually break down for you cohort response rates. So if you have a population that skews in one direction or another, they could skew towards an age group demographic, they could skew towards a language group demographic, or they could skew international, you're going to want to cover these things, right? If, for example, let's say you have a large pool of Korean customers, you know, you may very well want to consider sending out a breach notification letter both in English and Korean. Okay. If you have a large cohort of people that spend a lot of time in Korea and in the United States, maybe you want to keep your call center open longer than otherwise, because, you know, people sometimes go to Korea for a month at a time. And if you only kept your call center open for a month and there's a piece of mail, you know, your mail notification letter waiting for them in their mailbox in the United States, they may not get that letter until they get back from Korea. Then they open the letter, they say, oh my God, my information was stolen. They call the 1-800 number and they get a recorded message saying, you know, thank you for calling, you know, the call center is closed, you know, here's the company number to call since the call center is closed. So you want to think about all these things. You want to make sure, believe it or not, that your most important information on that letter is on the front of that letter, not the back of that letter. You'd be surprised how many people do not turn over a two-page letter. But you want to think about all these things ahead of time. And indeed, ideally, what you want to do is actually talk to a breach notification vendor through counsel before you've ever had a breach to get some of these basic decisions down pat and the flow of information and the decision-making down pat even before you have a breach. All right. So your breach has happened. It's over. You got a request from the state attorney general. You answered their question. Happily, nothing has happened. The state attorney general seems satisfied. Okay? And you think all is over, except for your after-incident analysis, which we'll get to in a moment. You think all is over, and then you find 2 months later that a plaintiff's class action law firm has set up a blog looking for representative plaintiffs to serve as class plaintiffs in a lawsuit against you. What do you do then? Well, there's frankly not much you can do about that. You can obviously monitor the blog. You can obviously, you know, put in place a litigation strategy. You can reserve funds for damages. You may have an obligation to notify your insurance carrier about that incident. In the case that I'm referring to that we sent out the letters on most recently, nothing ever happened. We were never sued. But as most of you know, the statute of limitations, you know, on these types of claims is not a 90-day statute of limitations. Oftentimes, it's several years. Now, I don't want to run out of time. I think I have about 10 minutes left. Okay, I think I have about 10 minutes left. Let me just mention one key piece of this, which is the final piece, and that is the after-incident remediation and analysis, because you should never let a good crisis go to waste, okay? There's a lot to be learned. You could be the victim of one of these types of incidents. Again, it does happen. Or what happens more frequently is you as a manager could go to another company, and that company could suffer a data breach for the very first time, okay? So you want to do a good after-incident remediation so that number one, you can improve your company as long as you stay there, but two, if you go to another company, you can say to that company, look, I've actually been through one of these data breaches. We keep a lot of data. We keep it in unencrypted format, you know, we et cetera and so forth. All these, you know, all these lessons that you've learned, you want to transport to your new employer. Not because it's going to eliminate the possibility of your new employer being victimized again, but because if and when you are, you will be in a much better position to protect your company and protect yourself. Okay, so you do an analysis after the fact, again, supervised by counsel for the reasons I described, involving what to do, what can you do to prevent this type of incident from occurring again. You're going to obviously look to any improved technical security and logging that you need to do. You're going to maybe change some of the access permission controls to the database or your most critical portions of the database. You're going to change maybe some of your data collection and storage practices, right? I mean, I've seen companies that have lost people's names and social security numbers in combination and therefore have a reportable event. And then you say to them, well, why were you collecting people's social security numbers? Do you really need this? And they say, no, it's just a good way of distinguishing, you know, one John Smith from the other. And you say to them, well, if you distinguished one John Smith from another using some other number, maybe a randomly generated number or some other metric that is not a social security number, you may actually not have had a reportable event at all. So why bother collecting social security numbers if you don't need them, okay? And indeed, some laws in some states prevent you from doing that anyway. So those are my remarks. There's a lot, obviously, after the fact you can do. It's going to depend naturally on the nature of your breach. I think I've left you with kind of an understanding of the most key and salient features. I think we have about probably 10 minutes left, and I'd be delighted to answer questions on this topic or any topic that you might have.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors. Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for information about memberships and to learn more about all the programs available at the Korea Society.